Hey, ladies and gentlemen, we are on the internet. This is the meeting of the Public Utilities Commission. It's October 20th at about 9:30 in the morning, and we're here in the State Capitol building. This is the time and place that was noticed for this meeting. I am Dusty Johnson. Joining me here at the meeting are my colleagues, Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. We've got an agenda, an addendum to that agenda, and a second addendum to the agenda. At this point, my intention is to take the complaint docket, then take the ETC dockets, and then go through things otherwise in order. And unless my colleagues have a problem with that, that's the way we'll handle it. So, but first, we have a very important announcement we're excited to make. Some of you may know that our Deputy Executive Director, Heather Forney, was lured away by the dastardly Board of Regents. But we've been able to replace her, I think, with some very able bodies. We've got Leah Moore, who's no stranger to those of who work with the Public Utilities Commission. She's our communications expert, and along with those communications duties, Ms. Moore is also going to be our Deputy Executive Director and supervising our administration staff and being part of our management team. So we're very excited to have Leah in that role. And then we also have Cindy Chemnitz. Cindy comes to us from the Department of Social Services. She has a great track record of experience with state government, very well respected. We are happy to have her. She'll be handling our financial and accounting and budget issues. Again, I think we're very lucky to have Cindy with us. So, I think all of you, or at least most of you, probably are familiar with the trepidation that comes with having a new job. You just begin to wonder at some point, have I made a horrible mistake? So if you take a moment to be nice to Cindy and let her know that much of what she has heard about the commissioners recently is not true, I think that'll help us with the retention. Well, with that, let's go ahead and turn to Ms. Gregg for an update on the Consumer Affairs Division.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 94 contacts since the last report was prepared for the October 6, 2009 Commission meeting. 26 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 37 of the contacts involved electric service, 8 contacts involved natural gas service, 3 contacts involved cell phone service, 7 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 1 contact involved the Keystone Pipeline, and 12 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 2,001 of the 2,051 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved.
Thank you, Ms. Gregg. Any questions? All right. Hearing none, we will move to our complaint docket, CT09-002. This deals with Eunice Caldwell of Peer against Email Discount Network regarding some unauthorized billing. And we did have a recent filing asking for the commission to dismiss and close the docket. Mr. Barsky, are you on the line?
I am.
Okay. Any comments in addition to what you filed with the commission?
No, we settled with Ms. Caldwell, and we hope this matter is put to bed.
Wonderful. Thanks, Mr. Barsky. Staff, Ms. Gregg, Ms. Semler, any additional comments?
None. Other than that, we do understand Ms. Caldwell did receive the settlement, and she's comfortable closing the docket.
Great. Thanks. Any questions for any of the parties? Hearing none, any action? I would move that the commission dismiss and close the docket. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And we will skip down to our telecommunications portion of the docket, specifically items number 2 and items number 3. These deal with a request to receive ETC status for both Northern Valley Communications and James Valley Wireless. And the question for the commission today is, shall they grant that ETC status? Good morning, Mr. Kramer, Mr. Groft.
How's that? Very good. Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for moving us up on the docket this morning. I am Jim Kramer. I'm an attorney from Aberdeen, and with me is James Groff, the CEO of Northern Valley Communications and James Valley Wireless. And on the docket this morning are the applications or petitions for both James Valley Wireless and for Northern Valley for ETC status. And I think it would be easiest to probably take the James Valley Wireless one first. James Valley Wireless was granted ETC status in 2006 and is a wireless provider providing service in the James Valley service area and also the Redfield area. This petition seeks ETC status in the Aberdeen service area of Quest. James Valley Wireless does provide all of the supported services and does provide service throughout the Aberdeen Quest service area. So I think it would be appropriate to approve its petition for ETC status. Be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go ahead. Let's see if staff has any comments.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Terry Labrie Baker with staff. James Valley Wireless have filed according to our administrative rules. They've supplemented their filing as requested by the commission to clear up some of those issues, and staff is recommending that the commission grant ETC status.
Okay, thanks very much. Any questions for Ms. Labrie Baker, Mr. Kramer? Ms. Wiest.
Yeah, I had a question about if a customer in Aberdeen would call James Valley Wireless and eventually would order wireless and wireline service. Would they be a customer of both James Valley Wireless and Northern Valley?
They would. We would actually just send them one bill, a Northern Valley bill, but it would indicate on their bill that they're getting wireless service, and they would actually be considered a James Valley Wireless customer.
So for the purposes of the two companies, then they would be a customer of each.
Right. They're structurally separated, yes.
And then if they get a package deal with your other services?
Correct.
That would be the same thing. They would separately be considered a James Valley Wireless customer.
Correct.
In that. Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Why don't you go ahead and address Northern Valley then, Mr. Kramer?
The Northern Valley petition seeks ETC status in the Quest area of Redfield and Quest in Aberdeen. Northern Valley is a facilities-based provider and has been in Redfield for a couple of years and has been in Aberdeen for the better part of 7 or 8, probably 10 years now. It serves throughout the Quest area in Aberdeen and in Redfield, either through its facilities-based or through its subsidiary, James Valley Wireless. It provides all of the 9 supported services, serves throughout the area, and I would ask that the petition be approved.
Staff, comments?
Staff would have the same comments as in the previous docket and would recommend the commission grant ETC status.
Thanks very much. Any questions? Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm hoping you can help me. I don't like to confess publicly ignorance, but I'm having a real struggle here trying to figure out the differences between these two companies. There's some obvious slight differences, but I'm concerned that there is an ETC application basically for two companies that to a great extent overlay one another. And that those ETC monies are basically then going to the same company from two different applications. Can you help me with that?
Well, that's true, but they would be separate customers. It's much like the discussion that Ms. Wiest and James Groff just had on the James Valley Wireless side. If you are a customer in Redfield of Northern Valley and have wireline service, then you would the ETC status would apply to that customer getting wireline services. If they are a customer in Redfield that is getting wireless services through Northern Valley, it's not a doubling up. It would just be the one service and only one ETC payment for that one customer.
Couldn't they just be one company? That's my struggle. Couldn't they just be one company? I mean, is there?
Structurally, they're not. Northern Valley was established in the late 90s, and the wireless company, James Valley Wireless, was established about 3 years ago. So structurally, they're separate companies. James Valley Wireless is wholly owned, or Northern Valley, James Valley Wireless is wholly owned company of Northern Valley, but it provides the wireless services. Northern Valley provides the wireline services or landline services.
If I may, Structurally, the reason they are separate is because one's a wireline CLEC and the other one is a wireless CMRS provider, so it's structurally better to have them separate for those different business purposes.
So there's no intent in bringing the two of them together?
No, well, no, not structurally. Okay. And when I say structurally, I mean, you know, on paper, two separate corporate entities.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Ms. Wiest.
But do they operate separately? Their financials are separate and everything is separate? Is that correct?
Correct. The financials are separate. From a practical standpoint, staffing and that type of thing, because it's a wholly owned subsidiary, we a lot of joint duties there, but on paper they're two separate entities.
So if I live in Aberdeen and I call Northern Valley and I request service from Northern Valley, and it's in an area of Aberdeen where Northern Valley does not have facilities and cannot provide landline services, at that point, you offer them wireless services. Would that be correct?
If a customer requested service in an area of Aberdeen where we did not have wires, we could provide the functional equivalent of a wireline by using a wireless local loop. We could put a fixed terminal in the home that would serve the entire home just like a wireline would, but it would be a wireless local loop rather than a wired loop.
So you would use wireless local loop to serve? Would that be for the entire Aberdeen exchange?
Yes.
And when you provided wireless local loop, would that customer still be a customer of Northern Valley?
If we serve them with a wireless local loop that was the functional equivalent of a wireline service throughout their home with a fixed terminal, we would consider that a Northern Valley customer.
And you could do that throughout the Aberdeen, even in the rural areas?
Yes.
And then for Redfield, would that be the same?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. And just one other question. You also said you lease services from James Valley Wireless. Was that in Redfield?
That would be the way that Northern Valley would be considered that wireless loop, because it would be James Valley Wireless's service. Northern Valley would lease that wireless loop from James Valley Wireless.
And that would be true. You just mentioned it in the James Valley Wireless, I think, supplemental filing. Or you only mentioned it with respect to Redfield, but that leasing would happen also in Aberdeen?
Yes.
And could happen throughout the entire exchange?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Good questions. Others? Yes. Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have struggled a lot in the past with the dilution of the Universal Service Funds. And at the present time in the Aberdeen and the Redfield areas, as you're well aware, there's ETC status and USF funds being provided to Quest and Verizon and Altel and Midco. And from my standpoint, I really struggle with that. In spite of everything that you've discussed to this juncture, is there something you can help me over the hurdle with that?
In the Aberdeen Exchange, there are no USF funds available.
Oh, okay.
In Redfield, they would be considered comparatively very small to what you'd see in a rural ILEC territory.
What unique programs do you bring to the table here?
Well, I think from a functional service standpoint, it would be identical services a dial tone, calling features, things like that. But obviously, we believe we bring a higher quality there with newer facilities and local staff, a deeper staff in the area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Any action or comments? I might just throw out a comment. I mean, I view these applications as primarily centered on Lifeline and LinkUp. I mean, that's really the purpose of them. And so, I agree. I think the lines of questioning have been really, really good. I mean, they've hit on, I think, some technical areas that I had concerns as well. But the big picture is that, you know, you don't have access to Lifeline and LinkUp unless you're a customer who is doing business with someone who's an eligible telecommunications carrier. So I do think there is some value in, although, frankly, these ETC votes are just lousy. They're close calls, the last several of them we've done. I think it is difficult to identify unique service offerings. I think it's difficult to, you know, talk about what's the impact on the Universal Service Fund. I think, you know, nationally right now, the telecommunications policy landscape is a joke, but we can't fix that today. What we can do, I think, is give more people access to Lifeline Link Up. So, any other discussion? If not, then I would make a motion to approve both applications for ETC status and both the James Valley and Northern Valley petitions. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries. Both motions carry 3-0. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Calling it a joke was maybe a little harsh, but. All right. We'll go to our natural gas portion of our agenda, which is NG09-001. MDU has filed for approval of natural gas conservation programs and conservation tracking adjustment. And the question for the commission today is, shall it approve the proposed revised program? Montana, Dakota, comments.
Thank you, Chairman. Commissioners, the filing before you reflects a portfolio of gas conservation programs we propose to implement for a two-year period starting in January 2010. To provide some brief background, we filed the new portfolio programs on March 2, 2009. Subsequent to that filing, we requested approval to revise the tracking adjustment at that time to collect dollars spent through February 2009 and extend the time for a decision regarding the new conservation portfolio in order to provide some time to work with your staff. We have had several meetings over the last several months and appreciated the time to work through this with staff. We believe we have a solid, cost-effective, and reasonable portfolio to offer to customers that will serve to promote energy conservation in South Dakota. And as a result of our discussions, the portfolio that is included in the filing consists of rebates for the purchase of 92% to 94% rated furnaces at $150 for $300 for 94% or higher. $50 rebate for water heater with a 0.62 energy factor in 2010, and $100 for a water heater with 0.67 energy factor in 2011. We're continuing our $20 incentive for programmable thermostat and have added a couple of new programs, an attic insulation incentive program and a new construction bundle consisting of a 94% or higher efficient furnace and a water heater for a base incentive of $300 with potential of an additional $100 incentive for meeting specified insulation criteria. All programs are shown to be cost-effective from both the participant and ratepayer impact perspective. We have removed the incentive for the 90% and 91% furnace originally included in the portfolio. The 2010 budget is $92,961 in total. We are also requesting a DSM financial incentive be approved in lieu of the loss distribution margin component we are currently collecting. The incentive is proposed to be awarded based on the actual expenditures and the rate of return adjusted for tax. A maximum incentive is set at the return on 125% of the budget and a minimum set at 5% of the budget. This return component provides an incentive for the company to promote and help achieve conservation while providing an offset to the loss of distribution recovery.
Ms. Averly, maybe if you could slow down just a little bit. You're breaking up ever so slightly.
Okay. And also avoid additional costly measurement and verification of DK savings achieved for a portfolio of this size. Finally, we are requesting to change the cost recovery time period to start November 1 rather than May 1, with a carrying charge to be applied to the under-recovered balance based on a three-month treasury bill rate, which is currently applicable to our purchase gas cost adjustment for balances. The tracking adjustment reflecting actual unrecovered expenses of $25,752 for the Black Hills rate area customers and $2,783 for East River customers, plus the 2010 proposed budget, will result in a charge of 0.019 cents per DK for both rate areas if implemented on November 1, 2009. This represents an increase of 1.4 cents and 1.5 cents respectively, or $1.50 to $1.60 annually. That concludes my summary of our proposal. Stephanie Bosch and Larry Oswald are with me here today also, and we're available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Staff comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Brian Rounds for staff. As you know, MDU was the first of our utilities to offer these energy efficiency programs. In fact, they started before we started requesting utilities to do so. And this is the first real update to their program since their initial program was actually to offer just two things. This expands that to, I think we're at six or seven now, different programs. With what was filed back in May, we've only made a couple small changes. We're trying to really decrease free riders on the program and its effect on the program. Really, the way we've done that has been to increase the efficiencies allowed on those heater rebates up from 90 to 92, and increased a little bit going into the 94% heaters. We considered doing that with the water heaters, but there's a real small number of models available at that really high rate at 0.67, so we left that at 0.62. I guess overall I'd say this is the best program we've done yet. All these programs show ratepayer impact measure tests above one, which should mean a net benefit for all the ratepayers, regardless of their participation. The incentive mechanism we've chosen is again something different. We're actually looking at giving them a return on their expenses, which in the past we've done that with MidAmerican and with Otter Tail. But when we did it, it was what that return was based on their performance. In this case, we're just going to do a flat return rather than worrying about verification and measurement to decide that performance, mostly because the cost of measuring and the cost of our verifying that measuring would probably be equal to what that would be. And the returns that they're going to get on those are going to be a lot higher than what MDU was willing to take. So with that, I would just suggest approval.
Questions? So, Mr. Rounds, I don't understand the incentive component of this yet. I mean, sort of rate basing these. I mean, absent some sort of an incentive mechanism, aren't the interests of the company really aligned in having these programs not be very successful?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, what real incentive they have in the other case, because we don't have a very good way of justifying or verifying the measurements that they make on what they do. So as long as we have a set budget, I'm not sure that it makes a whole lot of difference.
So maybe you can, and I should make it clear that I'm not suggesting that, you know, MDU wouldn't give these programs their best effort. I mean, I just think any company is motivated by a set of values. Money is one of those values, but there are certainly others for good companies like Montana Dakota. It just seems financially like the interests aren't very well aligned. I mean, walk me through, you know, and there were some nice charts, I think, that showed the minimum incentive and the incentive cap. Walk me through how that works, though. I don't understand that.
Yeah. Well, the minimum and the incentive cap really actually only come into play should they choose to spend outside of the budget that you guys approve? This is there's not an automatic adjustment. This is one rate that you're setting right now. I think it was 0.015 and 0.019, and basically they're going to make this return of 8.7. It's around 8% on their expenditures. As should they go over, should they spend 125% of their budget, they're still going to need you to approve the expenditure in 2 years when they come back in. However, you're sort of pre-approving that you're going to give them that incentive up to then when they do, assuming you do approve, they spend that much of the budget. So it's, the range is kind of it doesn't hold a whole lot of bearing at this point.
So again, just focusing on the dollars and cents. I mean, if I was going to be real cynical, which to a certain extent is our job, I would say, well, okay, you maximize revenue by doing two things: spending as much money as you can on these programs allowable by the commission, but also try to do so in a way that doesn't reduce your volumetric sales, because then you can recover from both sides of the ledger. So how are we to know that this is successful? And I understand the problems with measurement, I understand the cost with measurement. It just seems like this is a disincentive to doing to where we want to go.
I would say it's a disincentive. I see your concern, and I do feel that we do lose some by not having, you know, this measurement verification and have the incentive based on performance. But I think that, you know, by sticking with this straight return, we don't lose nearly as much as we lose with lost margin, recovery of lost margin, or that percentive mechanism. If you look at the other utilities we've approved, we're probably going to be looking at getting an incentive up to 30%. And if you look at lost margins, net present value of some of the lost margins that have been proposed or approved in the past, we're above 30%. And this is down here at 8. And I think that, I don't see what they're going to do to try to run this program into the ground, given the budget they have. I mean, they're going to give out, you know, high efficient or rebates on high efficient heaters. The programs are basically set in a way that really doesn't allow for a whole lot of fidgeting.
But doesn't the numbers you just quoted, I mean, doesn't that illustrate the problem? I mean, if it takes 30% to really get somebody to be motivated, you know, if they're saying, Brian, you got to pay me 30% to get me to do an A job, what kind of a job do you get when you pay 8?
Well, I don't. Maybe that's a question for MDU, but
yeah, MDU, you know what my concerns are. Any comments?
Sure, and this is Tammy Eberle, and I think the key is the budget that you see before you, and the majority of those budget dollars are incentives for specific programs. So we believe, and I guess we've agreed to that. We believe this incentive mechanism provides us the incentive to get customers to participate in these programs. Now, if we were to spend all of the dollar in all of these budgeted dollars in something that isn't producing a specific EK savings, as Brian mentioned, that is something that you would review at the time we come back in. So we will continue to look at our engineering standards, or, you know, the engineering estimates based on the programs that are being installed, and that will provide us a way to say that it produced X amount of DK savings and yet is not a specific bearing on the incentive. It is because we know that each of these programs passed the cost-benefit test today, and we would be implementing the programs in the way that we use to fashion this budget.
So, I mean, if some of the other IOUs in the state feel like they need 30% to do an A job. You know, what makes Montana Dakota so different?
In terms of Montana Dakota's portfolio, it's just very, we have a very, I would think, limited or, I don't know, limited focus program on those programs that we see as providing the biggest bang for the buck. And so I can't speak for the 30% incentive. What we're looking at is ways that we have in place to promote these programs. And we believe that this is reasonable and provides us that incentive to promote the program.
Okay, let me interrupt my line of questioning, see if there are others. Then I'll, you know, I look at a summary of the actual expenditures, you know, from March through August. So I'm on Exhibit 3, page 3 of 4. And I don't know, you know, it's not a huge time frame, you know, so maybe that's the issue, you know, and East River is not a huge natural gas system. But no takers on the programmable thermostat. Even in the Black Hills, you're talking about 20 takers. I mean, you guys know the ratios on a programmable thermostat better than I do. They're off the charts. I mean, 11.5 to 1 for the participant. I mean, I sort of feel like with some of these things, you either need to go big or go home. I mean, are we changing behavior? Are the incentives enough to get a delta, to get a change in behavior? Because if they're not, if they're just all free riders, then we're not doing anything. We're just wasting money. Thoughts?
This is Larry Oswald, and I think that the incentives are enough to change behavior, but there's also a lot of other mechanisms out there that customers can use, you know, i.e. the tax credits, and to help make it even more economic for them to make that change. So the incentives are built around trying to get that behavior change, but also knowing that customers can couple it with other things that are out there to make it even more economically feasible.
So given $20 and all these other incentives, nobody in Pier or anywhere else in the East River system said, yep, over a seven-month period, I want a programmable thermostat. Give me my $20. Am I looking at too small a time frame here? Or?
Chairman, I think it is. It's a, you know, because we've been running on an annual basis, and it does seem that summertime isn't, well, it would be a good time. It isn't always the time that people focus on those measures. I mean, on an annual basis, we have, and in total, we've seen, I think, some reasonable numbers given the size of our customer base.
This is Brian Rounds for staff, and I would just add that, you know, looking at what they had before, they had a very small offering of programs, and not a whole lot of money going into education outreach. I think with the new portfolio of programs, it's a more complete thing, which I think you're going to get more participation on all the other programs because there's going to be more awareness. Not to mention, you know, all the awareness that's come around in the last year or so with the aforementioned rebates and advertising that we've done, that the co-ops have done, that everybody else is doing. So,
well, and you hit on a point that I think, you know, Mr. Rounds is an area of interest in mine. I mean, I do think you need a critical mass of offerings. I think you do need to go big. I mean, I think energy efficiency programs done poorly are a very poor use of ratepayer dollars. I think done well, they can be very good. I think that the difference between programs done well and programs done, you know, not so well is getting to that tipping point, you know, where you're hitting people enough with enough money or with enough education where they say, you know what, yeah, I'm going to go do that. I mean, I don't know, are we really here, both for MDU and staff? I mean, do you feel like we're getting... Because when I'm looking at the numbers on Exhibit 3, page 3, they've done like anywhere near a critical mass to me.
This is Brian. I agree with you about what you need for programs, and that's why I like this program. I think we are there. I think this is going to be a good program.
Other questions? Yeah, Mr. Islov.
When I think of programmable thermostats, is the term you mentioned. Back to programmable thermostats, as the chairman mentioned. It's been about 15 years ago we looked at compact fluorescent bulbs, and there was kind of a war on incandescent at that point. We saw compact fluorescents being given away. They were being hawked at every home show, every public area the commission showed up, or they were there for more than 2 hours. And although there's tension between the cost of the program and the more rebates, the more facilities that go out there, the higher the cost of the program. On the other hand, there's a sense, I think, in the back of some of our minds that maybe we need to, you know, assault the public with at least the cheaper fixes, which yield so much benefit, and that would be in natural gas. It would be the programmable thermostats. You know, that there be a goal that everyone who consumes natural gas should be using, you know, that tool to help them cut their heating costs. And maybe I'm just wrong on this, but, you know, living in Pierre and now having natural gas, I don't feel assaulted. I don't feel as if I'm somehow politically incorrect by not having a programmable thermostat, which I do, by the way. But there appears to be, in some cases, maybe not the sense of urgency that I think perhaps some would like to see in getting at least the less expensive fixes or the less expensive alternatives out in front of the public. And it's just a thought. It's not a criticism. I understand the program and how it's expanded, and MDU really is, I don't know if a pioneer in South Dakota in this case, but certainly they were the first, and I think this is a major improvement in the program. But it appears that you know, maybe we need a little more rah-rah, and I'm not criticizing MDU or staff. It's just an observation in general across the state that somehow it seems these energy efficiency movements have somehow gone on the back burner. And I'm comparing that to some other states I've been in where the rates have gone so high that they really are on an all-out assault to somehow improve efficiency within their customer base. Thank you.
Other questions? Comments? I don't know that I'm crazy about this, you know, changing the lost revenue and the incentives and, in essence, just kind of rate basing this. I am a skeptic. That being said, the folks on the telephone line with MDU and certainly Mr. Rounds know a lot more about this than I do, and so I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, and I really want MDU to prove me wrong. I just really wonder if there's not an explicit incentive mechanism, if we're going to see the kind of heat and energy and passion that I think Mr. Islaw was talking about. You know, and I'm kind of a market guy. Part of me thinks, well, when you get $8 gas again, well, that's when all the heat and energy comes. The problem is studies show again and again that for some reason people respond more to education than they do to price signals. And so I do think MDU as I expect, you know, I hope they will step up the efforts, and these new suite of offerings, I think, will be more attractive and maybe hit that critical mass. But I am a skeptic. So let's hope in a year or two I'll be eating a ton of krill. Other comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I know that you have been a champion of energy efficiency and of a variety of different areas and arenas in where we can work to save our natural resources, and sincerely appreciate that and recognize the struggle that you're going through with this. I'm more hopeful, I think, than you on this. I think it's a good program. I'm glad to see that they're working forward. We would all like to see it be more successful than we might anticipate it being. and from track records and things of that nature. However, I'm very supportive of it and hope that the rest of the commission will support it as well. I'll make a motion at this time that the commission approve the proposed revised program.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. All right, with that, electric item number one, which is EL09-009, is the request for Xcel Energy to increase its electric rates. But the question for the commission today is, shall the commission suspend the imposition of the tariff for an additional 60 days? Staff is the moving party. Any comments?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and we've been working with the company on this. The current deadline, I think, is somewhere near the end of October, so we would ask to extend it for an additional 60 days.
Any comments from the applicant?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Xcel Energy in this, Northern States Power Company, doing business as Xcel Energy in this docket. Xcel Energy agrees with the request. There has been a healthy flow of data requests back and forth between staff and the company. I think we're well over half the data requests, I think, are answered, and we're moving along. So, but these things sometimes take time, and we agree with the request.
Given the broad impact of a docket like this, any other person wish to make comment? Hearing none, any questions? Okay, hearing no questions, any comments or action?
I'll motion in electric item number one that the commission, electric item number EL09-009, that the commission have these additional 60 days.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson will tie. Motion carries 3-0. With that, electric EL09-015 is the power plant at Deer Creek Station. We might as well take that up along with the hydrocarbon pipeline item number one, the associated pipeline facilities. There are two questions before the commission today. We'll take the first one first, because it does deal with both, and that is, shall the commission grant party status to any parties that have filed? I saw Brookings County come across. I don't think anyone else has. Brookings County, any comments? Hearing none, any comments by the applicant?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Casey Jacobson on behalf of Basin Electric, and we have no opposition to Brookings County's party for application for party status.
Thank you. Staff?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would recommend granting intervention to Brookings County.
Okay. Any questions? Hearing none, any discussion or action?
I will move that the commission grant party status to Brookings County in HP 09-002 and EL09-015.
Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson will tie. Motion carries 3-0. Then the second question with regard to the local review committee really should just apply to the electric docket and not the hydrocarbon docket. We have had some information in from the local review committee. Anyone from the local review committee wish to make any comments? Hearing none, staff, any comments?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. And Mr. Youngling, as you know, is on the phone, and he is the consultant if you have any questions for him. Otherwise, staff would recommend granting the local review committee's request for $10,500 to hire a consultant.
All right. The applicant, Basin Electric, any comments?
This is Casey Jacobson again, and we also would recommend that the commission approve this request.
Thank you. Mr. Youngling, do you want to make any comments?
No comments particularly. The application or the local review committee is only charged with the Basin Electric Deer Creek Station, and not the gas pipeline. However, in all the discussions we have with local officials, those two all kind of come together and they have the same issues, so it gets covered.
Great, thank you. Any questions?
We're just doing this for your electric docket, correct?
Well, the statutes only envision a local review committee for a energy conversion facility and not for a transmission line, you know, pipeline. But that being said, I mean, I think Mr. Youngling's right. You know, the local review committee, these things are so interrelated, one would think some topics would come up.
The question is wrong, and then on the hydrocarbon, do we?
It is. I think we'll just ignore it.
Ignore that. Okay. That was my question.
Other questions? Any action or comments?
I'll motion in electric item number two that the commission grant the local review committee's request for $10,500 to hire a consultant.
A motion has been made. Any discussion? I'll just make some discussion. I mean, the more we deal with these, the more I think it's a really interesting component of South Dakota law that we empower local governments, you know, not only to form a local review committee, but then to be funded through the applicant. I think this is a neat process, and I think heretofore the local governments have been involved in a great job. So, and I'm sure this group of local governments will also do a good job with Mr. Youngling's help. Other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Mr. Youngling.
Thank you.
Electric item number three does deal with the application made by Black Hills Power, a request to increase their electric rates. And the question today, we'll take the first one, suspend the imposition of the tariff for 180 days. Staff, any comments?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. And pursuant to SDCL 4934A14, staff would recommend the commission suspend the operation of the schedule of proposed rates by Black Hills Power for 180 days beyond September 30th.
Applicant, any concerns, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. This is Lee Magnus. I'm one of the attorneys for Black Hills Power, Inc., and we are supportive of the staff recommendation and have no objection.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Kramer, you're making history. This is the first time we're using the 180 days, right? Any other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Oh.
Sorry, I would move that.
I was ready to vote.
No problem. The commission, I move that the commission put forth the imposition of the tariff for 180 days. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
I was going to amend it to 3 years, but I thought that might be a little much.
Being in violation of state law is always kind of titillating, isn't it? So, Hanson?
Hanson votes yes.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. The second question does deal with whether or not the commission shall assess a filing fee for actual expenses not to exceed $100,000. Ms. Kramer?
Thank you. Pursuant to SDCL 49188, staff would recommend assessing a filing fee for actual expenses up to the statutory limit of $100,000.
Applicant?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, we are supportive of the staff recommendation and have no objection.
Any questions? Hearing none, any action or comments? I would move that the commission assess the filing fee not to exceed $100,000, the statutory maximum. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we get to pipeline safety. Item number one, this is a request for a ruling, for a declaratory ruling regarding whether a pipeline operator's documented maximum allowable operating pressure can exceed the limits in state law without a siting permit. But the question before the commission today regards a requested extension by staff. Staff, comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Semler for staff. Although I think it's fair to say the parties to the docket don't necessarily agree on the proper answer to the legal question, we have agreed to a solution that will deal with the current problem and the problem in the future if it should arise. We do, however, need some time to draft that solution, and we need some time to present it to you. So asking for more time at this point, and I'll look to Mr. Gertis if he'd like to add to that at all.
No, I agree with what Ms. Semler says, and I think it's in everyone's best interest to pursue the avenue that we've chosen, and we do need a little time.
And looking at the blurb, it appears as though we've got just MDU and Northwestern and our interveners. Anybody else want to make any comment? Hearing none, questions? I'm trying to remember the letter, Ms. Semler. Was it an open-ended extension? I don't think I saw a date certain.
I think I asked for 90 days, and that'd be 90 days from the expiration of the previous 90 days, which will run here in the next couple of weeks. I don't remember that exact date.
Okay, perfect. Thanks for the reminder. Other questions? Any comments or action?
I'm motioning pipeline safety item number one that we approve the or grant the request for extension.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
Thank you.
Telecom item number one is the Prairie Wave reduced rate case. The Prairie Wave, or rather, Nology has filed a motion to dismiss the complaint. Nology, your comments? Ms. Ford? Hearing nothing from Ms. Ford. Anything from reduced rate?
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, I was on mute.
Well, good job. Good job being muted, though. We'd rather have you do what you just did than what some people do, which is apparently go to the bathroom with the mute off. So, no.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, no, it's not. Go ahead, Ms. Ford.
We filed this complaint case, obviously, some time ago, and then the staff did a show cause against reduced rates. We intervened in that docket and then withdrew from that docket. But they did reach a settlement agreement with reduced rate, and we have not had any indication that the problems that we were experiencing have continued since that time, so we would like to dismiss this complaint.
Thanks. Any comments from reduced rate? Any comments from staff?
Staff would just echo what Ms. Ford just said. It appears as if the problem has stopped.
Thank you. Any questions for any parties? Any comments or action? I would move that the commission grant the motion to dismiss. No second is being required. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We've handled telecom items 2 and 3, so we will proceed to TC09-083. This deals with wide voice communications and the request for a COA. Mr. Toomey, are you on the line? Mr. Toomey on the line? We're not hearing you, so we'll go ahead and set aside telecom item number 4 for a little while and proceed to item number 5, TC09-087. This is a resale agreement between Quest and iNetworks Group. Staff, comments?
The agreement was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Any questions? Hearing none, any action?
I move that the commission approve the agreement.
Motion has been made. Hearing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 6 is TC09-088. This is Greenfly Networks and their request for a COA. And that's the question for the commission today. Anyone from Greenfly Networks on the telephone line? Seeing none, any staff comments?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Terry LaBrie-Baker with staff. We had a couple issues that need to get cleared up before the meeting today that we did not get cleared up, so we would just recommend that you either defer or take no action.
Okay. Anyone have a motion to defer?
A motion to defer item number 6 underneath telecommunications.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 7 does deal with Lattice Incorporated for their COA. Anyone from Lattice on the telephone line or in person? Hearing none, staff.
Thank you, Chairman. This is an application for a certificate of authority for inter-exchange and alternative operator services to serve inmates in institutions. We would recommend approval with restrictions on prepayments, advance payments, and deposits.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Any questions? Hearing no questions, any action or discussion?
I'll motion in telecommunications item number 7 that the commission grant the COA to Lattice Incorporated.
If I might add, with
the exceptions of staff that staff noted.
Perfect. Great. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We will proceed to the addendum 1. Just a single item, natural gas 09-007. This is a request for a contract with deviations between Northwestern and NuGen. And the question for the commission is, shall we approve that contract on less than 30 days' notice? Northwestern, any comments?
Yes, good morning. This is Jeff Decker with Northwestern. Northwestern is approached by NuGen Energy regarding the lost and unaccounted for fuel charge. Currently, they are charged the regular 2.05% fuel charge that is applicable to our distribution system. It has been discovered that there has been a problem with the calibration of the Northwestern meter at location. In order to correct the problem, the meter needs to be removed and sent to the factory for calibration and testing. While the meter work is being completed, Northwestern will be billing NuGen using the Northern meter reads. Since the receipt point and billing point will be identical, there will be no need to bill NuGen for fuel. After the Northwestern meter has been calibrated and installed, Northwestern will monitor the usage variance between the Northern meter and the Northwestern meter. After collecting several months of data, once the meter reads agreeable, Northwestern will return to billing from the Northwestern meter. The fuel rate will then be the system rate of 2.05% or a separately filed rate for large direct net customers. We appreciate your consideration on this matter and are available for any questions you might have.
Thanks. Does NuGen have any comments?
We're in agreement with the filing.
Great. Thanks, Mr. McKinney. Staff?
Thank you, Chairman. As explained by the company, what this ultimately will do is attempt to have a customer-specific fuel lost and unaccounted for factor. Currently, Northern Lights ethanol plant up in northeastern South Dakota has this exception too, has been approved by a contractor deviation. The other ethanol plants that are on a similar situation have either had that addressed in or served pursuant to individual contracts with deviations where that has in some cases been taken into consideration. In other cases, it was an allowance was made for it in the determination of the rate. So other than that, we would, and understanding that this is only supposed to be in effect until next September, at which time they would have enough information to get the final metering system in place and have a specific factor based on historic usage at that time. So with that, we would recommend approval of the filing.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Questions?
Mr. Decker, do you have any idea when you'll be able to complete repairs?
Well, I guess I'm not sure. It may take a couple of months to get the repairs made, and then after the meter's back in, we're going to want to monitor the usage for several months to make sure it's consistent.
So is September a good estimate, or do you think we'll have to revisit this in September?
I think September is a good estimate, yes.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Of course, this is not a particularly small dollar item, Mr. Jacobs, and with my rudimentary math skills, it looks like about $200,000 won't be coming in. I won't say that because that's labeled confidential. So over some period of time, month, years, or many years, there'll be some revenue that won't be coming in to Northwestern. Those costs will have to be picked up by others on the system. So is the way that I should be looking at this is that this particular customer, they were frankly subsidizing the rest of the system. I mean, what they were paying with that, 1.89% wasn't a particularly good indicator of what the lost gas was probably was on their mini system.
Yeah, in the best world, each individual customer would be able to have a loss and unaccounted for factor derived for that customer. Obviously, that's not feasible with thousands and tens of thousands of customers. In the case where these customers are so large, I think it warrants the company to be as accurate as possible when it can directly measure what the loss in an account for factor. So you're right. If the factor is lower on a direct connect customer, it will move costs. It's not really a correct way to say it. From what is happening right now in this particular situation, yes, costs will move. However, if one thinks about it as a principle of fairness, when you can direct assess people on the costs they are at and accurately measure the costs they are creating, it's much better to assess them the costs based on actual information rather than just a system-wide number applied to everybody.
So. Sure, thanks. Other questions?
If I could, this is Greg Rislov. And that point is correct. If we go on system average, there may be a difference here, though, that has to be taken into account. We've got a long length of pipe serving this customer. And frankly, the averages reflect an average consumption, too. And so one could say that based on these facilities, the news of these facilities and this customer taking so much gas, it's a bit like the philosophy that goes with the declining block rate that, you know, a lot of the upfront costs would come early. Now, I understand on a volumetric basis we could say the same amount of gas would be lost per decatherm, but I think in this case the actual measurement, it's going to be interesting to see where that comes in compared to the system. I did have this question. There was mention of the two taps at T, if I remember correctly. And although this may not be important at this moment when considering this issue, it wasn't clear to me how they would affect this measurement and how the lost and unaccounted for gas would be assessed in any T area customer compared to this plant.
What they're looking at doing, or what we're going to do, is we'll take the northern meter reads, subtract two T-point reads, and that will be then the new gen billing. Now, the T distribution, the T system, I mean, from the point of delivery at the T tap to the individual customer meters, that's, we're considering that like a normal distribution system where you have pressure reductions, you have relief valves, you have meters getting changed out and gas getting lost, et cetera. So I guess we consider those as two different points, with the T system being like a regular distribution system.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I'm motion in natural gas, NG09-007, that the Commission approve the proposed contract with deviations and associated tariff revisions on less than 30 days' notice.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson.
Aye.
Colbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We'll do the second addendum, and then we'll go back and pick up Wide Voice Communications. If Christopher Toomey's on the line at that time. Electric item number one on the second addendum is EL09-020, and this is an electric service territory exception. With 30 days, less than 30 days notice, Ottertail or Whetstone Valley, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. This is Kevin Kogel with Ottertail Power. Really no further comments other than to thank the commissioners and staff for their consideration of the item on such short notice. Would be available for any questions.
Okay, staff.
Thank you, Chairman. As you said, this filing came in Friday. It's a serve a grain bin site, and the filing was complete in every regard that I can tell, and I just recommend approval.
Thank you. Any questions? You know, I wonder, the term non-commercial appears in one document but not the other. Kevin, any concerns that, I mean, when you've got a sort of a working production agricultural type facility, I mean, I don't know, isn't whether or not it's commercial a little bit in the eye of the beholder?
I guess I'm not following your train of thought, Commissioner.
Well, you've got And this is, I'm going from memory here, but I think in the agreement it doesn't use the word non-commercial, but in some of the supporting documentation filed with the commission it does. And I don't know, as long as it doesn't say in the agreement, it's probably fine, but I just don't know at what point an operation like that becomes a commercial one. I mean, there's certainly plenty of commerce taking place with this particular customer. And again, maybe it's not in the agreement, it doesn't matter. Mr. Smith might have some insight for us.
Kevin, did you have anything to add before?
No, I don't.
Uh-huh. I mean, I think there is one of the early letters that references that phrase non-commercial or whatever, but the agreement does not contain that particular language, and I think it's pretty clear. Honestly, I do. And to me, it encompasses this facility, period, as it is.
Okay. I guess, Commissioner, that would be our intent.
Okay, perfect. Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move in EL09-020 that the Commission approve the application for service territory exception with less than 30 days' notice.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Let's go back and pick up telecom item number 4, which was the docket that dealt with Wide Voice Communications and the request for COA. Christopher Toomey on the line.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Go ahead. Do you have any comments other than your COA application that's been filed?
I think a few comments first. Just as far as the intervention that was filed, or granted actually, the first of September, it was disappointing that I only received the actual basis of the intervention yesterday at 5:07. And I'd like to note about that intervention in particular, the bases for it. First of all, the 251F Telecom Act exception only protects rural incumbents from the requirement to interconnect with Connecticut local exchange carriers. Wide Voice in its application made it very clear that it has no intention of seeking interconnection with any rural LEC in Montana, nor does it seek to provide local exchange service in any exchange outside of Quest incumbent local exchange territory. So it seems a little premature for either the interveners to be concerned about what Wide Voice is going to do until Wide Voice has even begun operation.
Mr. Toomey, we're getting most of what you're saying, but you're breaking up a little bit. Sometimes slowing down your speech pattern sometimes helps.
Okay. I'll do my best.
Yeah, and if you're on a speakerphone, sometimes that causes problems as well. Go ahead, proceed.
Actually, I'm on a cell phone, and I'm taking my 4-year-old to preschool, so excuse me.
No, we all understand the excitements and burdens of real life, so go ahead and proceed.
Thanks. So in any event, the requirements for the certification application that in front of the commission, there are specific requirements that Wide Voice must meet. And I believe that Wide Voice has met those requirements. I believe staff would agree that Wide Voice has met those, and the certificate should be granted. To the extent that Midstate or the SPCA has an issue with Wide Voice's operations going forward, the proper procedure for them to follow to deal with that would be to file a complaint case at the commission. Actually, the best thing for them to do would be to come to Wide Voice directly and contact me directly and deal with it before we come to the commission.
Mr. Toomey, we had you good right up until you said that their proper avenue would be a complaint case, and in the next two sentences we lost you. So if you could repeat.
Okay. After that, the actual best procedure would be for Midstate or SBPA to come to me directly to discuss the issue before going to the commission. But in any event, right now, the actual basis of the intervention is largely irrelevant to whether or not Wise Voice Communications has met the commission requirement to be granted a certificate of authority. And one more just factual point as to the issue of the point of presence in Fort Thompson. That is owned by Native American Telecom Pro Creek. It is used to provide wireless broadband and voice over IP services to the reservation. That has nothing to do with the provision of local exchange services. That has nothing to do with seeking interconnection with Mid-State. Wise Voice Communications is the network consultant operating or ordering. They ordered that point of presence, and now they've turned the operation over to Native American Telecom. So I expect to raise that one factual point as well.
Mr. Toomey, we're missing a lot.
Okay, well, I'm done. I've made my point, and I'll let Mid-State respond or however the procedure goes.
Okay, thanks very much. We will turn to interveners, SDTA, Mid-State, Mid-State Telecom. Any comments?
Thank you. I guess I am one. My name is Darla Rogers, and I am appearing today on behalf of all the interveners on Mid-State Telecom, Mid-State Communications, and also SDTA. Mr. Coit was unable to be here today. As indicated in the letter that we filed with the commission yesterday, interveners are respectfully requesting this commission to delay the approval of this application today. And procedurally under the statutes, it appears that the way to accomplish that is to request an evidentiary hearing. So that's what we've done in this docket. As I stand here or sit here today, I cannot say with certainty that we're going to need to proceed with an evidentiary hearing. However, it appears to me from our perspective that there are enough unresolved factual questions that we believe need to be addressed before the commission should take action on the application. Specifically, we have some basic concerns that are still unresolved about this application, and these haven't changed significantly since we filed our intervention petition in this docket. The first real concern or question is the application for a certificate of authority fails to set forth with particularity the proposed geographical territory to be served, and we believe that that's required by SDCL 49-31-70. In addition to the ambiguities in the application itself, which we pointed out in our petition to intervene, Wide Voice has taken some actions since filing this application that seem to be inconsistent with the assertions that they will only offer service in the Quest or local service in Quest service areas. And I appreciate the fact that staff tried to get confirmation of this issue in a data request, and Wide Voice confirms there, yes, applicant is only seeking authority to provide local exchange services in the Quest territory at this time. But I would tell you that within the past couple of weeks, Wide Voice has had some telephone conferences with Mid-State Communication about establishing a POP or point of presence in the Fort Thompson exchange. Wide Voice ultimately did submit an ASR, an access service request, to Mid-State, and they requested installation of 24 SS7 AMI SF trunks from Mid-State in Fort Thompson. This is a two-way trunk group for the exchange of local traffic. The entity that is to be billed according to the access service request is Wide Voice. The contact person designated on the ASR is someone by the name of Tandy DeCosta, and he or she, that person is from Wide Voice. This access service request has been filled by Mid-State, So at the present time, it appears that Wide Voice has established a POP in Fort Thompson, which is not a Quest territory. Wide Voice has also ordered circuits from SDN. They've received a firm order confirmation from SDN, so the traffic can flow over those circuits from Fort Thompson to SDN, and then I would assume to Wide Voice's switch in California. As far as Midstate knows, and as far as everything that's been represented to Midstate, Wide Voice is paying for all of these facilities and for that flow of traffic. So it appears to us that there is some discrepancy between what Wide Voice has stated in its application and what Wide Voice has represented to staff and the actions that Wide Voice has pursued and what has actually occurred here. Wide Voice, as I said, submitted the ASR to Midstate. It's been filled. Midstate is billing Wide Voice for these services. And interveners believe that these facts need to be explored a little bit more before it is appropriate to grant a certificate of authority. The second thing that we need to consider here, I think, is, you know, if it's Wide Voice, I'm sorry, but I couldn't hear everything that Mr. Toomey said, but if Wide Voice is claiming that it's not provisioning the service in Fort Thompson, but it's maybe Native American Telecom, then we need to explore that as well. I think at the end of the day, you know, and what is that relationship, and who is or what is the entity that's actually providing the service? But at the end of the day, what we have here is we have a POP in Fort Thompson. It's there. A service has been established. That's not a Quest territory, and I believe that we need to explore that further. Finally, it's intervener's petition that further inquiry is necessary because the application itself is incomplete, and I think that's true in several areas. And again, I applaud staff's attempts to question some of the things in the application, but I believe that the responses maybe still leave more questions than provide answers. The application is incomplete, as I stated, with regard to the geographical areas, and that's required specifically under the statute. The application and even in the responses to data requests are completely unclear as to actually how this service is going to work. There's no reference at all to where the switch is, how the switching is going to be accomplished. There, in the responses to data requests, that's the first time we see an application for a waiver from providing financial services, and the reason for that, or financial information to the commission, and the reason given is that the company has not yet begun to provide service. While the company has a web page, the company has been in existence according to their web page since 2008. It was founded in 2008 by award-winning industry veterans and pioneers. Wide Voice Communications is a CLEC certified facilities-based network operator providing wholesale TDM and VoIP services to voice application service providers and carriers. Wide Voice is privately held and is self-funded by its principals and is debt-free. Well, how do you know that unless you can see some financials? Certainly, if they've been around since 2008, there should be something that this commission could be able to view. So for those reasons, we're respectfully requesting an evidentiary hearing. And as I said, if we don't need to go to that point, that's fine. If Mr. Toomey is willing to engage in some informal discovery, that's fine. Otherwise, we have prepared formal discovery that we're ready to submit to see if we can maybe answer or at least satisfy some of our concerns, and particularly with regard to the circumstances surrounding that POP in the Midstate or in the Fort Thompson exchange. So that's the reason for our request, and we would really respectfully ask that you would grant it.
We'll go staff, then we'll give Mr. Toomey a brief opportunity to for rebuttal. Staff, any comments?
Thank you, Chairman. With regard to the completeness of the questions asked by staff, I have to beg a little ignorance in this matter because I haven't worked on a number of these for quite a long time. I don't know to what extent the answers commonly received by other staff members are, but I guess I can understand that there was some, in certain circumstances, more information has been provided. I think that in the past, when I made recommendations on certificates of authority, I have done so with the amount of information that was supplied by the applicant in this case. I mean, the question before the commission today seems like, shall we approve this certificate of authority? The checklist has been gone over by staff. We asked appropriate questions and received answers to our questions. In our mind, I guess those were, you know, adequate. But certainly I don't profess to have the intelligence of interveners or even other staff members that work on these things. So I mean, it's a little bit difficult for me to make a recommendation as to the completeness of the filing. I did think it was complete, however, subject to other people making a decision on it. Other than that, you know, regarding the question of, we specifically did ask about serving in the Quest territory, and they agreed that they are limiting their local service to Quest territory. That's what the answer to the question was. You know, we feel comfortable making a recommendation with the rural safeguards and things like that. It seems to me, again, and maybe I'm getting into the legal realm of this, but the question today is, shall the commission approve the COA and not whether the applicant is conducting operations beyond what it is currently certified to do? It seems to me a different question before the commission. So that.
Thanks, Mr. Jacobson. Mr. Toomey, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. It seems to me that the interveners are trying to insert themselves as the protector of public interest or something in this, in their intervention. As far as, and I believe the staff is the proper entity to decide whether or not the requirements have been met for a certificate to be issued. As far as the issue of territory, the application was clear and the response, I think, was clear. I'm not sure how much more clear only providing local exchange and Quest territories and inter-exchange service where available in the state of South Dakota. I'm not sure how much more clear that can be. As far as the issue of the point of presence in Fort Thompson, those SS7 links are required, necessary, to provide voice over IP. In effect, then, Midstate and SDTA have an issue with Wide Voice's application because Wide Voice is helping Native American Telecom, Wide Voice acting as a consultant in this case, helping Native American Telecom bring the most advanced telecommunication services in the world to the reservation, where otherwise they would not occur. That seems sort of odd. As to the other issues, I believe it's staff that's responsible for deciding whether Wide Voice meets the requirements specifically to have a certificate issued, and not the interveners to decide that. And that's all. I'll leave it at that.
Questions? Ms. Rogers, I mean, he does mention the securing those securing those facilities that WideVoice has done so for, you know, non-telephony type applications. I mean, if that's the case, what should lead the commission to doubt what he's saying? I mean, to doubt what's in the application?
Mr. Chairman, and the reason we brought this up, I mean, I'm not trying to stop and step in front of a train wreck here or an air train, anything like that, but what they've established is a two-way trunk at Fort Thompson. So that means that there can be a call from a mid-state customer to a wide voice, whatever it is, customer, and that is going to go around a path, but it's going to come back. They can exchange local traffic there, and that point of presence is there under pursuant to an access service request. And so my understanding is that there is, in fact, local service being provided in Midstate. Midstate is certainly concerned about that particular point of presence or local service that's being provided there, and I don't think that this commission should ignore that fact, and I think it needs to be explored further. To me, procedurally, the best way to do that is to grant our request for an evidentiary hearing, and we are parties in this docket, and I believe that we are entitled to request that from the commission. And so that's the reason. We're not, you know, we're not trying to step in the shoes of anyone else here. We're just trying.
I mean, you can lease a trunk to do things other than haul switched traffic. I mean, switched voice traffic, right?
That it may very well be.
So, I mean, is it really for the commission to determine if anybody makes any moves that could be roughly construed to be driving toward the provision of, you know, telephony, switched voice traffic, that then we need to have a full evidentiary hearing? I mean,
a full evidentiary hearing may not ultimately be necessary, Commissioner Johnson. What I'm saying is that because we are aware as an intervener that service has been provided and it's up and running, we would at least like the opportunity to explore that and to determine whether or not we care about it, whether it really affects us, and whether we are interested. And that's what we're asking. I'm not saying that we're necessarily on the path of an evidentiary hearing. It just seems that that's the procedure that's in place. So that's why we've requested that.
I'd take any advice of Commission Counsel. Any thoughts on this?
I don't know, and maybe commissioners have some other thoughts.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll go ahead and pause and see if they have any questions before we turn to you, John.
I just have Ms. Rogers, do you know what the locations are? Is it from the Midstate CO to where? Is it to a cell phone tower, this trunk? Where does it terminate?
That's a good question, and I'm not an expert on interpreting or reading access service requests, but it appears to me like when it says install 24 SS7 AMI SF trunks from, it's Fort Thompson, South Dakota, and then there's an XA, and I think that means they're central, Mid-States Communications Central Office, and then it's two, and it's another location that I don't know where that is, but it's not Mid-States Central Office, but it is in Fort Thompson, South Dakota. So, and like I said, I do know that it is a two-way trunk, so there would be the, you know, they can exchange local traffic both ways over that trunk.
Mr. Toomey, you were kind of cutting out during that. Do you know where that trunk terminates and if it's used for two-way voice communications?
As far as I'm aware, it's connected to a wireless facility, and it is used completely for data, meaning.
I'm sorry, Mr. Toomey, you're breaking up again. I'm not sure what the problem is, but it seems like you start out real well, and then right when you're just going to tell me what I want you to tell me, you break up.
Okay. Data and voice over IP. No local 2016. And if Mid-State had...
I wonder, Mr. Toomey, if it wouldn't be better if we just pause for a moment and try to have you call back in. Sometimes we can establish a better line that way. We're just not getting anything of value from you right now, and I don't think it's because you're not offering it. It's because we're not receiving it. So do you have the phone number, the call-in number handy?
I do. Can I call back in 5 minutes?
Mr. Toomey?
Yes.
Pretty much, this is Commissioner Hansen. Pretty much every time you start chatting with us, it's very, very clear. Are you relaxing your voice and moving the phone slightly away from you? Can you continue to project and try one more time?
Can I call back?
Well, you're doing great right now. Just try and explain the question one more time and continue to project the way you are.
Okay. Can you hear me okay now?
Perfectly.
Okay. The trunk group, as far as I'm aware, is connected to the wireless facility, and it provides data traffic only. And my definition of data traffic includes voice over internet protocol. It does not, these trunks do not carry local.
We're losing it again right now.
I just think we're in a situation now where we're not able to have the proper exchange of information. Unless my colleagues want to do something different, I would make a motion that we put this on the next agenda and that Mr. Toomey can get himself a hold of a more solid connection, and we'll deal with this then.
Mr. Chairman, I'm quite ready to vote. Did you just make a motion, or are you just suggesting?
Yeah, I threw out a suggestion.
Some discussion here. I think we're dealing with several different issues here. The main issue is a COA. He's made an application, and that application, according to staff, has followed all the information that is required. The fact is that they've said that the application is for the Quest area, and it's up to us to decide not all of these peripheral items at this time. Those items are directly related to whether or not there's a violation of the COA. And so I think we need to grant the COA, and then if, in fact, there needs to be an evidentiary hearing to determine whether or not they're in violation of the COA. And so I'm offering that for discussion at this point. I'd make the motion, but I really think we need to grant the COA and then go forward with all of these other issues to ascertain whether or not there is a present or future violation. And otherwise, what's the point of having an evidentiary hearing?
May I comment on that, please?
Let's do this. I had asked for Mr. Smith's comments earlier. We'll go to Mr. Smith, unless Commissioner Kolbeck's got something first.
Well, I didn't agree with Commissioner Hansen at first, but I kind of do now. I think as long as we're going to talk back and forth whether it is, whether it isn't, we're not going to decide that today. So I think Commissioner Hansen's got a good point. What is the question in front of us today, and if that meets the requirements? But before Mr. Smith speaks, I'd like to know, when he does speak, how do we get the enforcement coming if there is a violation?
And then before you answer, I'll let Ms. Rogers and Mr. Toomey know that they'll get one more bite at the apple here, very briefly, to respond to some of the issues we've had raised. Yes.
I think the way in which enforcement would occur would be via either a complaint brought by either staff or an interested party, such as Mid-State, which they clearly are. One of the confusing things I have here, and again, it's down to it sounds almost wide voice. We have so many of these that I forget which one it is. It sounds like the services we're talking about are not local exchange services, right? Ms. Rogers, aren't the services you're talking about transport and or interexchange services, where we're talking trunking?
And I guess maybe to respond to your question, again, I'm basing my understanding on the dealings and what's gone on as between Wide Voice and Midstate. But there is a two-way trunk that has been established, and local traffic can be exchanged between them. So my whole point is not, is there a violation? I'm not even saying that. I'm saying maybe there needs to be an amendment to the certificate of authority, and maybe there needs to be some, you know, conditions or protections in the granting of that. And so that's why I think we have brought the questions in front of you in a manner to deal with them before you grant the certificate, because perhaps that application does need to be amended. And I think that it would be much more efficient to do that now and to answer these evidentiary concerns now rather than to come back and have to address them later. We don't want to have to file a complaint against them. Hopefully that won't be necessary. Hopefully we can work through some of these issues. And, you know, I'm not here. I mean, I can't give you factual testimony. Neither can Mr. Toomey. That's why we need the opportunity to explore these further. Hopefully it won't go to an evidentiary hearing, and we'll be able to resolve the issues between the parties and go our merry ways. But I think that it is timely to request the evidentiary hearing, which we've done, so that we can answer these questions or get answers to them prior to formal action.
Okay, you had indicated you wanted to respond to Commissioner Hansen.
I think I tried to do that. That's the reason why we followed the procedure that we did here and requested an evidentiary hearing, because, and I think it's timely, and I think it's the right path to go in this case.
And then, Mr. Smith, you sort of raised the issue, an additional issue, but do you have any comments about the...
Well, I do, I think. One reason I asked that, though, is just to clarify, and part of it gets down to this, that, and I think you've answered me, is that if the primary objection, the real substantive objection of Midstate, relates to the provision of local exchange service, and all we're talking about here is inter-exchange service, either through dedicated transport services or something like that, then my point, Ms. Rogers, was just to figure out if there isn't really an issue. It may still mean they're in violation of our law, though. If they're providing transport services without a COA, they're still performing telecommunication services, unless they're purely something that's outside, if it's maybe in the realm of an information service or something like that. But I mean, that's possible. But I'm just trying to clarify I think you answered me and you said you don't know. You don't know what they're doing, right?
And if, you know, if it turns out, as you said, that there, I mean, I know that the two-way trunks are there. I know that there can be the exchange of local traffic in Fort Thompson. And so it seems to me that we would like to have the opportunity to get more definitive answers to your questions, and that's why we've gone down the path that we have.
Even if the local, and again, I don't think we can answer it here today, that issue, even if we were talking the exchange of local traffic, does that necessarily mean then that this company is a local exchange carrier?
Well, and I'm raising the questions. I don't have the answers for you, but it appears to me that from what we've experienced in Midstate with our dealings with the company, with the access service request, it appears to me that there is local service that is happening there, and it's not an Aquest exchange. And so for those reasons, I think we would like to have the opportunity to explore that. If it turns out that that's not the case, fine. If they need to amend their certificate to include other areas, and again, the safeguards that would flow from that, then this commission can do that. But I think that we need to have some time to determine, to find the answers from factual people that can give them, and consultants and people from Midstate, and that I didn't know of another way to get there without asking for the evidentiary hearing, so that's why we went down this path.
Right, and I think, I guess the thing, and Commissioner Hansen, you know, I totally respect where you're at on this. I do. It does occur to me here that there may be a couple of factual issues, and again, are they going to end up being relevant? I guess the concern I kind of have is maybe, especially with the extreme difficulty of understanding Mr. Tomey on the phone today, as to whether it might not be worth, and I realize we're up against a deadline, the 60-day deadline. I mean, that's one of the issues. To me, if we can, if the request for hearing is viewed as even arguably justifiable, then we stay that 60-day period pending fleshing that out. I don't know. I don't know that it wouldn't be maybe worthwhile in this particular case to take a little time and try to figure out what's going on here. I mean, one thing I'd mention too, and just again, it's not quite relevant to the application per se, but you know, it if we have a company out there that is currently providing services without a COA, at a minimum, that raises at least the issue. I mean, that's the kind of thing we take away people's COAs for. So there may be enough there to at least dig in a little bit and see whether, and we learned this. We're like you, Mr. Tomey. We didn't see this. I didn't see it until this morning. So it's all new stuff as of just now. And maybe erring a little bit on the side of affording the parties a little more time to dig into the facts might be not a bad idea. Again, that's just some thoughts.
Okay, let's give Mr. Tomey an opportunity to respond, and then Commissioner Hansen kind of had the floor before we started this last round, so then we'll go back to Commissioner Hansen in case he's got any action. Mr. Tomey?
Let me check first and see if you can hear me better now.
I think so, yes.
Good. I'm on a landline now, and I'm available for any questions that the commissioners may have, and I'll try to answer them more intelligibly now. The issue here is a question of whether or not Wide Voice has met the statutory requirements for a certificate of authority to be issued, not whether there's any existing violation out there already or whether Wide Voice is acting improperly in any way prior to the grant of a certificate of authority. I find it odd that Midstate, first of all, processed this access service request. If they had an issue with it, the time to investigate that was months ago. They intervened and were granted intervention status the first week of September. And what have they been doing since then to investigate what kind of traffic is here? This seems really just some sort of pointless delay tactic. The issue is whether or not Wide Voice is qualified to have a certificate of authority to operate in the areas that it has requested. Quest areas. The traffic being provided right now is information service only in those areas. If Midstate has evidence to the contrary, they can file a complaint case. Or, given the issues that have been raised thus far, Wide Voice will cooperate with any informal staff inquiry into the nature of this traffic. But delaying this further when the evidence exists right now that Wide Voice is qualified to be granted a certificate of authority seems unnecessary.
Thanks, Mr. Trimmy. Commissioner Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the dialogue that's taken place. After that period of time, I'm wondering whether or not Mr. Jacobson would have anything to add at this juncture.
Yes. If the commission would like to make a decision now, staff would recommend granting a certificate of authority subject to the condition that DTI not offer any prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and not accept or require any deposits or advance payments without prior approval of the commission, and be subject to rural safeguards. Commission staff further recommend a waiver of ARSD 2010-24-029 and ARSD 2010-32-03-12, and also condition the granting of the COA with getting a sales tax number and submitting that to the commission.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would like to incorporate that in a motion at this time, if you're ready for one.
Go ahead.
I will move that on TC09-083, the commission grant a certificate of authority to Wide Voice Communications Incorporated according to the recommendations from Mr. Jacobson.
Okay, thanks. Any discussion?
The interveners still have the ability to, even if the COA is granted, to question what that service is for, correct, Mr. Smith?
Well, in terms of would they have discovery rights, the answer is no.
No.
Unless they would have to file a complaint, and then that would trigger discovery rights. Or staff could do an investigation, and that would, again, we'd be talking a violation proceeding at that point.
Sure. I've just got too many questions to vote yes on the COA right now, so I think I'm going to vote no on the motion.
Any other comments? I'll ask we've got a pending motion. I'm going to ask a procedural question about an alternative to that motion. I mean, Mr. Smith, what you mentioned staying the 60 days. I mean, if the commission does not approve the Hansen motion, what alternatives exist to us?
Well, at this point in time, we have a 60-day time limit on certificate of authority applications. Upon the filing of a request for hearing, that extends that. It extends it to 120 days, so it doubles the amount of time. It would just stretch out the deadline by filing that. In effect, the deadline gets stretched by an additional 60 days from the deadline. The original deadline, which, as I understand it, is imminent.
The original deadline has passed, but we considered completion date from receipt of data requests that completed the application.
Okay.
And I'm sort of stretching the germaneness of my questions here a little bit, so if Commissioner Hansen's got a problem, just say so. But I want to explore this alternative just a little bit. I mean, is there some middle ground between the granting of the COA today and an evidentiary hearing? I mean, could, in those areas where concerns have been raised, could affidavits be provided by the petitioner to better flesh out those areas?
Sure. I mean, I think so. I mean, I suppose, you know, you can grant that it's subject to conditions, and one of those might be, you could do that, subject to the applicant's agreement to provide additional data that you might specify in your motion. I mean, I think we could go down that road if you wanted to.
Okay, well, that's kind of helped me get here. I mean, I think what Commissioner Hansen said earlier is pretty much spot on. My one residual concern, I feel as though the interveners have raised some legitimate questions. I mean, Mr. Toomey, would you be opposed to having someone with your company provide an affidavit, making it crystal clear that there would be the concerns raised by Ms. Rogers wouldn't come to fruition, that there isn't going to be some sort of a telephony local exchange service type product provided in the Fort Thompson area?
Sure. If it was attached to the granting of the application, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I mean, any order granting the authority will specifically say that WideVoice is not permitted to provide local exchange service in any areas other than those where it's entitled to provide them. There could be a stipulation filed where WideVoice makes that even more clear, but me
yeah, I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, I would consider that a friendly amendment to my motion.
Well, you know, Mr. Toomey's probably not right. It's not necessary. But, you know, Ms. Rogers, what concerns, what residual concerns would you have?
Excuse me. The concern that I have with going down that path is if you grant the certificate of authority, interveners are basically have no standing to have any input or any other part in the process. And, you know, it is Mid-State Service territory here that is affected, and their interests are affected. I would like to have the opportunity to have some input and some responses maybe to any affidavits or factual things that you call for as a commission, because, again, these are factual things that Mid-State and the other interveners need to have some input in as well. That's why we've asked for the evidentiary hearing. I'm not saying we need that whole extra 60 days and that we need to go all the way down that path and take all that time, but we would at least like to have some input in exploring the questions, the factual questions that we've raised.
Well, I guess I'm a little, I mean, I thought you raised three, you know, legitimate concerns. I mean, if we've got the applicant willing to say that they're willing to flesh out those concerns you've raised, I'm not sure what else is left. I mean, you've got the COA to review. I mean, if there were other concerns you had, you would have had an opportunity to raise those as you did in your letter of yesterday.
But I think that our standing, so to speak, to be able to flesh out those concerns as you're speaking of would not be there once you grant the COA. We wouldn't have the opportunity to be part of the process to flush out the issues that we've raised.
Well, you would have the authority, this is John Smith, Commission Counsel, you'd have the authority to bring a complaint, however.
And I guess that's, I mean, we were really hoping
right.
to avoid that and not have to open a whole new docket. And I mean,
sure, I know. And I've been reluctant here. I mean, on one side of me wants to burrow in and ask Mr. Toomey, are you, in fact, providing trunking services right now without a COA? But on the other hand, I'm not quite sure that's a fair thing to ask in this situation, so I'm not going to, because that hits me as a complaint situation where he's on notice that we're going down that path. But I don't know. You know, again, my gut feeling is to err on the side that we've had a request for a hearing. Statute affords an interested party the right to request that. Again, it delays things a little bit, but I guess I would tend to err on that side. But I understand your point of view too, Commissioner Hansen, and it's a close call for me. Thanks.
Well, I don't want you to amend your motion, Commissioner Hansen. I really appreciate your willingness, but I'm not sure I could vote for that, so I don't want you to do it and then not even get a vote. You wouldn't purchase a vote with the move. So we do have a pending motion. Any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Nay.
Johns votes nay. Motion fails 1-2. Other actions?
I guess I don't know what the appropriate means would be to just defer this until or we go into discovery.
Well, we've had a request for hearing, and I don't know. I guess I just don't know what the typical process in the past is. Have we had to do a suspension request, or do we just assume that that's an automatic happening?
Well, I think the statute's pretty clear. But if an evidentiary hearing is required, the commission shall act on the application within 120 days of receipt of a complete application. So we've got another 60 days. I don't know if there's any wiggle room.
Okay, I think by denying the motion, and we've got a request for hearing that's filed, I really think that's it then. And I think this just moves along, and we'll have to take it up at a later date. And Mr. Toomey.
I to me, it just seems like these things should be able to be resolved without a full evidentiary hearing. I mean, I wonder if discussion with the parties couldn't allow the concerns of intervener. I really believe they're going to be sad. I believe they're going to get the answers they seek. I believe that ultimately their concerns are going to be resolved, and I don't know that we need an evidentiary hearing. So I would ask the parties, is my suggestion a decent one? I mean, can you all have a conversation and perhaps resolve your concerns?
We are certainly willing to do that, yes.
We can try. This is Chris Toomey. My concern is just that I'm not sure how to satisfy Midstate. They processed the ASR months ago. They intervened the first week of September. It is now the 20th of October. They've had plenty of time to ask questions. My issue is I wonder what their intent is here.
I need to clarify a point that Mr. Toomey made that I don't believe is accurate, and I don't have the exact date in front of me, but my understanding is the ASR was not submitted until September 24th, so we're not talking about months ago. This has all occurred within the last 2 weeks.
I believe discussions with the parties occurred months ago. The ASR was submitted more recently in time. I apologize for the misstatement.
Well, we better get moving towards setting dates then. I mean, we're really going to have a hearing. We're going to be jammed for time. So I guess let's move toward a hearing, and at least this commissioner would really urge the parties to resolve their complaints without having to go to hearing.
Right, and I
concerns.
Think on the issue, Mr. Toomey, of what could you provide? I mean, just some things, some more specificity about what the function and the nature of the trunks and whatever else you have over there are, and would probably be helpful. Again, if you're just providing transport, if that's it, or if these really are demonstrably just information transport services for sure, but it's really tough at this point for anyone to know what are the nature of those lines.
All right, I think everybody knows where we're headed. Do we need another formal motion, or are we good to go? I mean, do we...
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I think they need some specific direction as to what information is being requested of them.
You're wrong. Yeah.
I mean, you know, just to say we need more information.
I would prefer some specific questions be asked so that we can answer them and not have a delay continue. Because I didn't answer the right question.
All right. No, that's fair.
Excuse me, yeah. Commissioner, if this is helpful at all, we have prepared some interrogatories to try to address these specific issues and get more information to address these. We have a draft ready. Mr. Coit just needs to go over that draft, but we're ready to go with those. So we will submit those right away. We're not going to sit here and delay. We will work with them, try to get our questions resolved, and try to avoid an evidentiary hearing if at all possible.
That would be good news to this commissioner from a standpoint of timeliness if that information is ready. You said you're going to submit it right away. I think that's...
Yes, we are ready to do that.
The best news I've heard from this docket so far. Thank you.
Well, I've been told by one of my colleagues that a break is needed soon, so let's try to wrap this up. I would move that the commission grant the request for an evidentiary hearing, instruct the interveners to supply interrogatories by Friday so that we can expedite this, and that work with staff to put together the remainder of a procedural schedule to drive toward hearing.
Yes, and staff would request either we be copied on all questions and all answers, or it be entered right into the docket.
Yes, we would intend to do that. Thank you.
Perfect. There's a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll see the vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
John Phillips, aye. Motion carries 3-0. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
John Phillips, aye. Motion carries 3-0.